It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. That's some sound of protesters last week in opposition to the election of Donald Trump, who marched through Iowa City to Interstate 80, in fact, blocked traffic along Interstate 80, an exit there. Iowa Republican lawmaker Bobby Kaufman says he's annoyed at what he calls the hysteria erupting at university campuses after the election of Donald Trump. He plans to introduce in the coming session what he calls his Suck It Up Buttercup bill. Legislation to stop what he says is coddling of students with taxpayer money. Joining us now to talk about this proposal, one that's gained national media attention, and also some other legislative priorities for the coming session, Des Moines Register State House reporter Breanne Fonensteel. Hi, Breanne.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit about this proposal by Representative Kaufman.
Sure. So, you know, this kind of came about from media reports across the country of university students kind of struggling to deal with the outcome of the election, you know, holding quote-unquote cry-ins, you know, having lots of sharing sessions, things like that, where, you know, there's these really public displays of kind of grief or protest of Donald Trump. And so, as you mentioned, Bobby Kaufman kind of considers this coddling and thinks that, you know, students need to suck it up and get back to class. And so he's got this proposal that would cut funding to state universities, taxpayer-funded universities that, you know, put extra dollars toward these efforts above and beyond what they offer through, you know, existing student groups or counseling organizations. And then it would also work to make, you know, tougher criminal penalties for people who block interstates and cause traffic jams through protests.
So what has been the reaction of, I guess, the universities?
Well, I think the first reaction from universities was, you know, this isn't something we're doing, is what they've told us. You know, we've had some of these protests, we've had some of these events, and organizations have put their efforts toward this, but we're not spending extra dollars above and beyond what already exists. That, you know, we think this is a good place for students to kind of talk about the results, and, you know, for many of them, this might be their first interaction with the democratic process. They might be voting for the first time, and so to kind of come together and find some common ground and, you know, talk about what happened, they think this is a good place for that.
And universities and colleges, we know that there's counseling of all types at colleges and universities for whatever reason, right? That's all in place, right?
Exactly.
So talk a little bit more about the new penalties for these protesters. They briefly closed down Interstate 80, or it was a, I'm not sure if it was an exit or entrance to 80, and this is something that this legislation would hope to stop as well?
Exactly, and that's something that when I spoke with Representative Kaufman, he mentioned that he had constituents in the area who called him saying, you know, my daughter's stuck at school, they closed the door behind her and I can't get to pick her up, or I've got a pet I'm on the way taking to emergency veterinary care. And, you know, the argument is, well, what if that had been a person? You know, what if there were a real emergency? And so he's bringing together some state law enforcement to kind of form a task force to look at the issue to see what tools might help them in dealing with this issue. You know, the state patrol said that they were able to clear that protest relatively quickly. I think the highway was back open after about 30 minutes, but you know, they consider it a public safety issue, so I think they're hoping to address that in some form.
In looking at this, Breanne, do you have the sense of whether this is something sort of a signal that Bobby Kaufman is sending out or real legislation that the Iowa House would consider?
You know, I asked him that, and he said he has every intention of proposing it and following through in the session, but I think to some degree it is a statement, you know, since there aren't any reports of, you know, schools spending taxpayer dollars to fund these types of protests, that, you know, this is where the legislature stands. And I think part of it, too, is frustration with trying to manage the budget and the Regents Universities asking for more funding and then raising tuition, things like that. So I think it comes back to a lot of different things that the legislature will consider.
Any reaction from the Democratic Party in the state?
I think the Democratic Party is pretty unified in opposing this proposed legislation. You know, I think a lot of them consider it a First Amendment issue, students' right to protest, things like that. But, you know, just on the other side, you've got people just as fervently supporting it. I think he's really struck a nerve here.
Let's talk a little bit about the upcoming session. You are the State House reporter for the Des Moines Register. On Wednesday, I understand House Republicans met for the first time after this election to select leadership. They began to put together their plans for the 2017 session, which begins in January 9th. Now, Republicans gained two seats in the Iowa House. Their majority now 59-41 over the Democrats. They also gained six seats in the Senate. The Democrats lost control of the Senate, so now the Republicans have a clear majority in both chambers. Linda Upmeyer of Clear Lake, Speaker of the House, Representative Chris Hagenow of Windsor Heights, a majority leader in the House. So now with complete control of the Iowa legislature, what can they do now, Breanne, that they couldn't do before?
Well, they can do just about anything they want, honestly. And so I think the challenge for them will be to kind of clearly outline their priorities and, you know, make sure that they can keep their caucus on board. You know, I think we're going to see things like tax reform, education reform, things more in the vein of school choice rather than school funding, which has been the discussion the last couple of years. You know, I think we'll see Second Amendment issues come up, kind of just the whole laundry list of conservative issues that, you know, the House Republicans have tried to pass for the last 6 years and have been blocked by Democrats in the Senate.
Mm-hmm. And Democrats now in a minority in both houses are left to do what? They can't do anything.
Right, and that's kind of what it will be interesting to see what their game plan is during the next session. You know, their goal might be to cause a lot of noise and to get people up there protesting, or it might be to find some common ground and probably a combination of both.
Well, thanks so much for the update. Des Moines Register State House reporter Breanne Pfannenstiel, thanks very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Protests this week in Cedar Rapids over a police shooting of an African-American man who is now paralyzed. The man who was shot on November 1st, Jeremy Mitchell, joining us to give us an update on it. Iowa Public Radio's Sarah Bowden, who's been following this story. Hi, Sarah.
Hey, Ben.
So, recount, what happened during the shooting on November 1st?
Yeah, so around 1:15 a.m., there was a traffic stop. Officer Lucas Jones pulled over 37-year-old Jeremy Mitchell. Some sort of altercation happened. It escalated. Officer Jones fired his weapon and went through Mr. Mitchell's neck, and now he is paralyzed. And we don't know how the situation escalated or why, and we don't know why there was a traffic stop in the first place. But we do know that Mr. Mitchell is paralyzed, and Officer Jones is on administrative leave with pay.
Mm-hmm. So a lot of questions surrounding the shooting. Was there a dash cam or other video?
There is a dash camera video. It has not been released yet. The Department of Criminal Investigation, the Iowa Department of Criminal Investigation, says that that would jeopardize the integrity of the investigation. And so they are not releasing it, nor is the city of Cedar Rapids, which is the custodian of the tape as well. They're saying that they will release the tape when they get the okay from the Linn County attorney. Mm-hmm. But people who are protesters and supporters of Mr. Jeremy Mitchell are very upset about this because they feel that in other instances, information has come out far quicker when there have been other officer-involved shootings or other violent incidences. I'm not sure if that's particular to dash cameras or just information in general, and they're upset with the lack of transparency.
Mm-hmm. So you said there's an altercation. We really don't know too much about what happened, or can you tell us any other details that have been released?
So some sort of altercation happened, and according from a press release from the Department of Public Safety, it says that Mitchell began this altercation, but his family and friends are saying this doesn't sound like him. They describe him as a Steve Urkel type or Carlton from The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. Those are their words, and very cool-headed. And they're saying that this doesn't sound like him. So there's confusion, there's hurt feelings, there's anger. And they're like, and their thoughts are, if something happened, why can't you just release the videotape? Why can't we see what happened?
Do we know anything else about the officer now on administrative leave, Lucas Jones, who was involved in the shooting?
Ooh. Well, he's a 5-year veteran of the force, and last year he was involved in another shooting, this one fatal. That one was ruled, there was another officer involved as well, and that fatal police shooting was ruled as justified. But people are upset because this is the second time he has fired his service weapon at a member of the community. People are saying, the protesters are saying that he should either be fired or permanently placed in a role where he's not allowed to use force because they see him as trigger happy.
So what is the city of Cedar Rapids saying about this shooting?
Well, the Cedar Rapids Police Department released a statement saying that it does understand concerns, but requests more information voiced by some members of the community regarding the shooting. Otherwise, they're really not saying a lot, and that's because it's an ongoing investigation, and they're saying that they can't say a lot because they don't want to jeopardize the investigation's integrity.
Mm-hmm. And there have been protests over this. How many protesters?
You know, it's I think the protests are fairly consistent, and the one I attended, there was about a dozen people.
Mm-hmm. And you spoke with some of the protesters?
Yes, I did, including his niece. She said she can't talk. The family isn't talking a lot on advice of their lawyer, but they're saying that they just really want the dash camera video. And protesters have a list of demands, including the dash camera video and the immediate release for the reason for the altercation. But they also want the Justice Department to investigate and appoint an independent prosecutor because they say that the DCI and the Linn County Attorney are too close to the city of Cedar Rapids police force, and they're concerned that their bias may exist and that a fair investigation of the shooting will not take place.
Mm-hmm. I understand you also talked with the Cedar Rapids branch president of the NAACP, Diedrich Doolin.
Yes, I did talk to Mr. Doolin. He was at the protest I attended, and he says that he wants there to be a more cordial and positive relationship between the police force and the Black community in Cedar Rapids. And he's concerned, and people in his community are concerned that there isn't enough transparency.
Well, people don't understand. They're feeling like it feels like there's not transparency. They feel like there's a feeling it's been a long time and nothing's been shared. And people, there was a recent shooting where officers killed a young man who was stabbing a woman. And at least that's the way the report was presented. And, you know, it appeared to be justified based on what was reported. But this is not one of those situations. So they're saying that the information came out sooner about that. Now, people say it's different, but there's a lot of questions about it. And a lot of people in the community want to know what really happened. They want to see the footage. And, you know, we're hoping that can get out sooner than later. You know, we know that the law enforcement says, you know, this is an active investigation, and they're trying to, you know, not have an adverse effect on the investigation. But people in the community, they just want answers.
We just heard from Diedrich Doolin of the NAACP. Where does this investigation and the whole thing go from here?
Yeah, so right now the Division of Criminal Investigation says that there is no timeline for when the investigation will be complete. Officer Jones is on paid leave, and Mr. Mitchell is in the hospital paralyzed.
Okay. Iowa Public Radio's Sarah Bowden updating us on protests in Cedar Rapids over that November 1st shooting, which left a Cedar Rapids resident, an African-American man, Jeremy Mitchell, paralyzed. Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And now onto a fracking-related story. Here in Iowa, fracking, that process of injecting liquid at high pressure into rocks underground, this to force open existing fissures and get oil and gas. That's why we have the oil and gas boom that we have. In northeast Iowa, where they mine sand used in fracking, the Clayton County Board of Adjustment voted Tuesday night to approve a zoning change and allow the Pattison Sand Company to expand its operations. The panel's approval was the final step in a year-long process to rezone nearly 750 acres from agriculture to heavy industry, and this will facilitate the underground mining of the silica sand. This is a sand especially good for fracking, mined there in northeast Iowa. A study committee established by the supervisors in Clayton County found little air quality risk associated with frack sand mining. Joining us now, Peter Thorne, the team leader for a study at the University of Iowa. University of Iowa did on the health risks of airborne frack sand and community exposures during mining and processing. Welcome back to our program, Peter.
Yeah, good afternoon, Ben.
And we want to mention you're head of the University of Iowa's Occupational and Environmental Health Department. Tell us more about the study and its findings.
Sure, I'd be happy to. Well, as you said, frac sand is used as a propant to hold open these fissures in shale after fracking. And it's coming, a lot of it is supplied to the nation from the upper Mississippi Valley. And the Wisconsin supplying about 62% of the total U.S. production, and also Minnesota, but less than Iowa. Iowa has had the Patterson mine, which has existed for a long time as the sole source of frac sand. The issues that the community is often concerned with when they're facing the decision of whether to permit such a site is aesthetics and view sheds. In Wisconsin, most of these mines have been open mines as opposed to the Patterson, which is an underground mine. But also noise, truck traffic on small roads, increased rail traffic, and water quality issues. Our study was focused solely on air quality as the hazard of concern. And that's, of course, one that is important because this type of silica sand in occupational exposures such as sandblasting and mining can cause fibrosis of the lung and lung cancer as well.
Mm-hmm. But you didn't, the study did not come up with any health risks.
Well, what it really came down to is, are the exposures that are faced by communities amidst frac sand mines sufficiently high to cause these kinds of adverse health effects? And since these have been studied greatly over many, many years, there are federal and state standards that below which are judged to be safe levels of exposure. So we measured exposures to both the airborne dust and the crystalline silica at sand mines, processing facilities, transport facilities, and at homes of individuals who live within a half a mile of these facilities in Wisconsin and Minnesota. And then we also monitored rail transport routes, railroads. And then what we found is that although there are short-term elevated exposures, specifically when our monitoring stations are downwind from these facilities, the levels of particulate matter did not exceed national ambient air quality standards, nor the Minnesota or California standards that have been established for silica. So based on this, we would say the levels aren't reaching the levels that have been judged by federal agencies to be toxic to human health.
Mm-hmm. Some of the residents in the area there, northeast Iowa, would have rather than been a different outcome. They would have liked to have stopped the expansion of this. Does that mean, though, Peter, there are, this is just one small sliver, right, that you're studying? That doesn't mean there are no health risks to fracking, right?
Certainly. We were looking at the air quality issues, and a point's been raised in some that we have had public hearings in both Iowa and Wisconsin to disseminate our findings. And in those, residents bring up concerns, a lot of concerns having to do with water quality and tourism and view sheds and aesthetics and natural wonder and habitat, and those are all relevant issues to this discussion as well. The other one that we hear from people about is, well, what if you live in the middle of five of these types of mines or processing facilities? And in Wisconsin, where there are 92 active mines, indeed some people do find that they can be downwind all the time of a facility. Under those circumstances, they would be at a greater risk, and we didn't study people who live in those circumstances where they might have substantially higher potential for exceeding safe levels of exposure.
Mm-hmm. Peter, in this context, we have about a minute left, and any other aspects that need to be mentioned?
Yeah, I think the what's been adopted by many communities and counties is to try and put in regulations and zoning requirements and operating permit structures to ensure that the operations are conducted safely, and that when there is expansion or when there are citizen concerns, that there is a way to address those in a cooperative and civil manner. And I think that can be quite helpful. Iowa, I think, so far has done a pretty good job of up in Alamakee and Winneshiek counties, and now Clayton County, trying to take care of its citizens and ensure that these operations are conducted in a safe manner.
Okay, Peter Thorne, professor and head of the University of Iowa's Occupational and Environmental Health Department. Peter, always good to talk to you. Thanks.
Yeah, my pleasure, Ben. Bye-bye.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Well, this morning, I thought I might just need a, you know, shirt sleeves to bike to work today. I just stepped out the door, and it's cold out there, and it's windy. Well, joining us at such times of great temperature change, climatologist Elwin Taylor is with us, professor of agriculture meteorology at Iowa State University. Hi, Elwin.
Well, good afternoon. And yes, indeed, you are right about the windy and the changing temperature. And, of course, we were well above 50 at daybreak.
Yeah.
But here in Ames, now we're down to, well, something on the shy side of 45.
I might have to borrow a coat from someone when I bike home again. Hey, Elwin, we've got a couple minutes here. First to the crops. Great weather for crops. Could we have had better weather for the crops? They're all in?
Oh, it could have been better, but it was at least as good as last year, a little bit better than that. And we got a break in the rain, and most of the crop is harvested. Non-harvested places have a reason, such as a local condition or perhaps local problems with machinery. But for the most part, we've had the opportunity to get the crop in, and it's been a good crop.
Okay, so in the minute or so we have remaining, what's the change coming on us now? We're done with all that wonderful warm weather, I guess. It's not coming back.
Well, it looks like this is the end of Indian summer for sure, and at least for the temperatures well into the 70s. And we need some winter. Will it be a harsh winter? We don't have an indication that it will be extremely harsh, even though we're moving toward harsher winters, looking at the climate diagrams. And we look forward to next year, and people say, will it be a harsh summer? And yes, we do have a worry about that. There's a drought in the southeast. That's where major Midwest droughts always start, is down in South Carolina and in that area. And there's one there right now. We're watching it carefully.
Okay. Always good to have your eyes on the weather and the world climate. Climatologist Elwin Taylor, professor of ag meteorology at Iowa State University. Bundle up a little bit more than we did a couple days ago, and I will too, Elwin. Thanks.
Always good to be with you. I wish you the best.
All right. Coming up in our second half hour, the role of fake and satirical news in our election campaign. Blank Park Zoo is expecting again. This time, it's going to be a baby giraffe. And how texting can be used as a tool to help parents teach math at home. That's all coming up on this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, back in just a few minutes. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This week, Google and Facebook announced measures aimed at halting the spread of so-called fake news on the Internet. This is a move that comes as Google, Facebook, also Twitter, face a backlash over the role they played in the presidential election by allowing the spread of false, often malicious information that might have swayed voters. Joining me now, a University of Iowa alum who now teaches at Merrimack College. That's in North Andover, Massachusetts. And her recently created list of fake and satirical news sites has gained a lot of attention due to the election controversy. Melissa Zimdars joins us, assistant professor at Merrimack College, where she teaches communication and media. Hello, Melissa.
Hi.
Hi. Tell us about this list that was created. What is it, and how did you come to create it?
So it started as just a list for my students. We've been learning a lot about the culture of journalism and newspapers in the last month of our introduction to mass communication class. And I was increasingly concerned by some of the sources they were citing in their assignments or in classroom discussion, because they were citing sources that as authoritative without really considering the kinds of sources they were citing. And so that's where it really began.
Mm-hmm. And so you created a list of, can you give us an example of some of the sources, the sites that you came up with on your list?
Sure. So the list includes sources that are false, misleading, or potentially unreliable, sources that are otherwise okay but often rely on clickbait, which can sometimes exaggerate the contents of the article, And I also included sources that are satirical because it's shown that they have the potential to be read as literal or actual news. And so the point was for students to be able to understand these different kinds of publications and websites and to be able to navigate them knowing what they're about.
Mm-hmm. How many fake and satirical news sites do you have on your list?
I think there's about 140, and then people have suggested an additional 300 sites to consider. And I should say that in that 300, it includes, you know, the New York Times, Washington Post, NPR. So people are also saying that some of these sources rely on clickbait. And, of course, some fringe people think that those sources also circulate fake news.
Mm-hmm. Tell us, what are the examples you have of stories that are spread out there, fake news stories that perhaps even your students took as credible stories that were not?
Yeah, so one good example, on Monday, if you Googled the presidential election popular vote, the first Google News item that appeared was from a website called 70news.wordpress.com. And this was a fake news website claiming that Hillary Clinton actually lost the popular vote. And it doesn't cite any actual or verifiable information, yet this was the first source that appeared if you Googled this information.
Mm-hmm. And when it's the first source, that means it's getting a lot of clicks.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. So this led to conversations in your class with your students about what, how to become more discriminating as news consumers.
Yes. And I encourage them, even when they're encountering, you know, traditional mainstream news sources, that all articles have particular media framing or, you know, editing that goes into them. And while we can trust them, it's important to contextualize all of the articles we read with other sources of information. And it's about creating a fuller picture of the information that we're coming into contact with.
Right. But Melissa, this is really distressing because you have college students who were taking some of this as real news when it was fake news. I mean, what about the rest of Americans without college degrees who are not discriminating, who are going about their daily lives and looking on the Internet? That really gives you pause, doesn't it?
It does, but I will say two things. So I am a professor of media, and I was even duped by a fake news piece about Aaron Rodgers endorsing Bernie Sanders for president. And I shared this without verifying the source, and then about 15 minutes later, someone else was like, this is fake, and I was like, oh, man, I was just duped. Hmm. So, yeah, I do care about people that, you know, don't have the background in journalism and media and their ability to navigate, but I think we also need to understand and acknowledge that some people who are sharing fake news or otherwise unreliable sources are doing so even though they know that these sources are fake.
You've experienced some backlash, I understand. What form has that taken?
Firstly, most of the response that I've been getting is very positive, especially among librarians and educators, and even people who are thanking me for helping them navigate what they come across on social media. But as some of the sites on the list reported on the list, they basically proved why they were there by publishing outright lies about me and encouraging their readers to contact me and everyone I know. So I've, you know, been signed up for a lot of fraudulent websites by these people. My students have been harassed on the phone by them. And, you know, none of us have been directly threatened, but you know, people who know me have had their inboxes also flooded with hate mail. So,
wow, this has been a tough few days for you, Melissa.
Yeah, it's definitely been stressful.
Before we go, tell us, how do we identify fake news? How do we separate it when we're going through the Internet and see perhaps an Aaron Rodgers story or something else?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of things that people can do, and I think The first thing is even just making sure that you're reading what you're sharing. And if you're reading something and you're not sure, you can consider a few different things. One, is the news story attributed to a specific author? Google that author. Google the news source and read about what people are saying, if it's been reported anywhere. If it's a legitimate news source, there's likely a Wikipedia page with it. You can also just consider things like whether the article uses all caps frequently or really exaggerated language, like, you know, one political candidate destroying another political candidate. Most legitimate and reliable news sources don't use that kind of language and don't frequently use all caps in their reporting. And so there's a lot of other things people can do, but those are some of the beginning ones for sure.
Okay, very interesting. Melissa Zimdars, a University of Iowa graduate where she earned her PhD, now assistant professor at Merrimack College in Massachusetts, created, along with the help of her class, a list of fake and satirical news sites. Melissa Zimdars, thanks.
Yep, thank you for having me.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. It was just a few weeks ago, we reported on it. Did you hear about that? That the Blank Park Zoo in Des Moines told us of the birth of a baby black rhino. Now, more good news. Blank Park Zoo says one of their four giraffes is pregnant. Joining us to talk a little bit about it, Dr. June Olds, a senior veterinarian at Blank Park Zoo and clinician of zoo animal medicine at Iowa State University, and Lou Keeley, large mammal area supervisor at the Blank Park Zoo. Lou, Dr. Olds, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us again.
Dr. Olds, tell us, what's the name of the expectant mother?
Her name is Yuzuri, or we call her Zuri, and she's a 19-year-old reticulated giraffe.
Mm-hmm. Was it a surprise that she was pregnant? She is pregnant?
It was a surprise that she was pregnant. It has been 15 years since Zuri has had a calf, and we have been trying a few years ago, and she never got pregnant, and so we actually thought that she wasn't able to conceive.
Mm-hmm. 19, so 15 years ago, when she the last time she was pregnant. So she is, I have no way to judge a giraffe. Is a 19-year-old female giraffe an older giraffe?
She is an older giraffe. They can live up to 30 years old in captivity, but she is considered to be an older giraffe, and Lou can probably comment on that a little bit more. But,
yeah, Lou.
Yeah.
Yeah, so... Yeah, that was good.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, that was good. That's my comment.
Okay.
Okay. So Lou and Dr. Olds, what do you have to plan in the due date is when is for the baby giraffe?
We're thinking mid-December. So we know about from behavior and from our notes when she was probably bred from our male. So we're looking at mid-December. So there's all these physiological signs that we look for. So her milk bag's filling up, her teats are getting bigger, her belly's bulging out. And that's kind of how we knew. We could see all this fetal movement. And we're like, what is that? Oh, there's a little calf rolling around in there. And so, And then Dr. Olds and the vet staff, we were able to do an ultrasound on her. And we saw some great structures that kind of confirmed that she was indeed pregnant.
Mm-hmm. So what's the plan? Have you made a plan? Do you need to make a plan? What do you need to do differently now, Lou?
Yeah, so we have kind of a big old plan written out, so all the keepers and staff know what to do. So basically, it is separating Zuri out when we think she's getting close to giving birth. So in our barn, Zuri is she's stalled with three other animals. So overnight, we will definitely keep her separated. And so when a giraffe gives birth, she'll give birth standing up. So you can imagine that's a pretty large fall for that calf once it drops out.
So that's
six feet. So we want to make sure she's giving birth on a very soft substrate, so we'll heavy bed so that the calf has a nice, comfortable landing when she comes into this world.
And when a giraffe is born, can the giraffe, like a horse, does it get up?
Yeah, they kind of have to. You know, in the wild, that's when they're most prone to predation from lions and leopards. So they get up, you know, hopefully within a half hour or so, and they're up and nursing and walking around following mom.
Mm-hmm. You know, humans who are pregnant like to have special diets and care. Do we need the special care and diet, Dr. Olds, for this giraffe?
We actually have our giraffe on a really good diet, and so we usually don't increase the feed until after the calf comes. She's on a well-balanced diet that's a pelleted ration and hay, and then we give them plenty of browse. So she should be pretty set nutritionally as we go into this birthing process, and then as she needs to produce milk for the calf, then we'll have to increase her diet to be able to provide for the calf.
Lou, you get to see the giraffe, the mother, almost every day?
Every day, yeah. Mm-hmm. So we're working around them.
Do you notice that she's in a different mood?
No, behaviorally, I think she's doing okay. You know, no big mood swings here. But once you kind of start seeing them getting restless a little bit, then I think you really know the calf's on its way.
Uh-huh. Dr. Olds, is a birth of a giraffe very much different than the recent birth of a black rhino you had?
Well, I think it is. It is a big deal, like Lou said, because the giraffe is standing when she gives birth. Having that calf land softly is very important. Having it stand up within that first hour of life and start nursing is very important. So it is a big deal, and because of her age, we're going to be watching her really closely and make sure that everything goes smoothly.
Were all of your giraffes at the zoo born in captivity?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And they've got how large of an area to roam?
Lou, can you speak to the size of the exhibit?
I think it's about 3 acres, and they share that with another critically endangered species, addicts, and another bird species. So they get quite a bit of room to roam and stretch out their legs.
And we're increasing the size of the barn right now, too, so we'll have room for this new calf when it gets here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Tell us now about the baby rhino born October 11th, I have, right? Our baby black rhino. Mm-hmm. This is a rare creature, right? Fairly rare.
Extraordinarily rare. Of her subspecies, the eastern black rhinoceros, there are only about 800 of them left in the wild in Africa. So it's a big deal to have an eastern black rhino born in the United States.
Mm-hmm. How big is the calf now?
She's about 75 kilograms, which if you do your math, she's getting close to 200 pounds. So she's more than doubled in size since birth.
Mm-hmm. And female. And what is she like to do? She hangs around mom and does what?
Mom's very protective. She's usually around mom. With this great November weather we've been having, well, not today.
It changed, didn't
it? Yeah, it changed a bit. But she was out running around, rolling around in the mud, you know, doing all the things little rhinos like to do. We've had a bunch of great videos on Facebook that our keepers have taken of she loves, like, rolling around on enrichment items, so these big balls and tubes and stuff. She loves putting under her belly and rolling around, and she's just a little bit of a goofball.
Now, you haven't mentioned a name. Does she have a name?
We are actually having a naming contest. I think they're kicking it off
Giving Tuesday. Yeah, they'll be starting a naming contest at the zoo.
Oh, okay. So how do you enter?
You'll have to check for details on blankparkzoo.com. But it's donations of $50 or more, and you get to kind of suggest a name. And then there's going to be a little bit of a naming contest in the upcoming month. So check back with our site for more details, more than we can give right now.
Okay, and your mother and your baby rhino, they seem happy. Their mood seems good.
Oh, they're fantastic.
They're wonderful. Yeah, they're great.
How do you tell if a rhino's happy or not?
No, she's doing everything right. I mean, everything could go right. It did. You know, mom, she's still as sweet as ever, and that kind of rubs off on the calf. So the calf is very sweet to keepers, and she puts on a lot of shows for the visitors. The visitors have just gone crazy over her. Yeah. And you get to see her every day. And just to reiterate, we are open during the winter, so you can come see baby rhino every day.
Mm-hmm. Baby rhino, 75 kilograms. Mama's weighing in at about what?
1,200 kilos. Yeah, 1,200
Whoa.
Kilos. Yeah.
That's,
she's a big girl.
Yeah.
That's a car, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's so good to talk with both of you. I don't even know, what do black rhinos eat?
So they're herbivores. So they get a couple of grass types of hay and a pelleted ration. And they get some treats, too, some produce. They love apples and sweet potatoes that they'll use for training and such. So they have big appetites. You know, they eat about 50 pounds per day. A lot of poop, too. keeps us going.
Well, we are at the end, so I'm glad you mentioned that, Lou.
There you go.
All right. Lou Keeley, Large Mammal Area Supervisor at the Blank Park Zoo. Dr. June Old, Senior Veterinarian at Blank Park Zoo, clinician of zoo animal medicine at Iowa State University. So wonderful to speak with you two and hear about these wonderful developments at the Blank Park Zoo. And we do need to come check it out.
Yes, you do.
You do.
All right. Thanks, Dr. Olds and
Thank
Lou.
You.
Thanks, Ben.
NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Finally today, I guess something to consider the next time you have to admonish your kid once again for texting at the dinner table, you know, under the table. They do that, right? Of course they do. What about texting, though, as a tool to help parents teach math at home? Well, that's a possibility, too. It's being tested. Molly Applegate is with us, an assistant professor of math education at Iowa State University. Molly, along with her colleague, assistant professor Krista Jackson, they're testing an idea with texting and learning math. Professor Applegate, Molly, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
So what's this idea? How does it work?
Well, we are working with kindergarten teachers at Moulton Elementary School in Des Moines, and we are communicating, working with them to share with parents what's going on in the classroom each week, and then sharing a short 2 to 3 minute activity that parents can do at home.
Okay, so parents do at home, and the kid has the cell phone, as all kids do these days, and the parent does too. And so, are they sitting next to each other? Do they have to be in the room next to each other? What happens?
Well, so the activities are actually don't really – the way to communicate is the cell phone, but actually we could be – they're counting objects. This is kindergarten, so they're counting objects. They're figuring out how to make 10 things. They're counting spoons. They're counting socks. So they're looking for circles, the shapes that they're learning in kindergarten. So those are some different activities, but they're – parents could do them while driving. We're having people point out numbers or why they might be walking to school to point out and count numbers of objects.
Mm-hmm. And so, So you're texting them as well.
Yes, we're texting them potential activities to do at home.
I got you.
They can do it with their children. Yeah.
Can they text back and say it doesn't seem to be working or ask questions?
We're asking, yes, it is a two-way communication. We've been asking so far, the only question we've been asking them to respond to so far is, have they been able to do the activity with their child? But we'll increase that communication further on so that students, if we give an activity like, you know, point out 3 circles in your home and share one of those circles with your teacher, so they'll be able to text back a picture of a circle in their home, and then that can be posted in the classroom, and then the kids could share, hey, this is a circle that was in my home or around my neighborhood.
And I understand you're working with some parents who's for whom English is a second language.
Yes, that's actually how this started. We'd been working with the kindergarten teachers through a program called ISU for You Promise, which supports the students to come to ISU for college. And they'd been sharing with us their challenges in communicating with parents whose first language is not English. And we knew there had been studies about text messaging around literacy, but there hadn't been these studies around mathematics. We thought, oh, we can address the teacher challenges communicating with parents, and we can focus on mathematics. So that's really how this started.
Mm-hmm. So what's been the reaction so far? How would you gauge it?
Great. Parents have been very enthusiastic about signing up. We are also, they've been saying they're participating and able to integrate the activities into their daily routines at home. We are also experiencing similar challenges to the teachers and reaching some parents. There's work schedules, there's language barriers, so that's what we're working through right now, actually, to make sure we're able to reach all parents.
Now, a lot of parents, I'm sure, listening right now, a little bit envious that this is only taking place at a test at Moulton Elementary in Des Moines. Will this be expanded? What can we look for in the future if this is successful?
This is exactly what we want to do. We definitely want to expand it. We're actually hoping to work with kindergarten this year and then move up. We'll kind of see kind of from our data how useful it is with parents. We'll be continuing these surveys with parents, but also having parent focus groups to see what worked and what didn't, either the messages or the way of communicating. And we will definitely be sharing all of this, you know, information and these findings with other schools and other districts, because we want math to kind of we're math people, so we really want math to be a focus for parents. You know, parents are aware of the value of reading to their child each day, but they don't take time to set aside for mathematical.
Yeah, that's a good point. We have to go. Molly Applegate, assistant professor of math education at Iowa State University. Thanks for sharing us with us your idea with your colleague Krista Jackson. Good luck on it. We'll check back in.
Thank you so much.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Claire Roth, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Have a great weekend.